Some say the rise of online journalism has liberated the world's information, but in many ways, it's also removed the gatekeeper. The role of an editor is no longer what it was. Yet, as the news market evolves, some newspapers and magazines are seeing greener pastures beyond the geography of their traditional readership. Step aboard today as we take a journey across international borders. Today on The Stack. Coming up, as some publishers strip away their international bureaus, others say they're more important than ever.
Our main newsroom is in New York. We have a big newsroom now in London. And we also have one in Hong Kong.
Plus, a little later, as Bild's new soccer newspaper hits newsstands, we'll talk to the editor behind Germany's newest newspaper title.
It has always been our dream to produce a daily sports newspaper, you know, because we really believe in a product that is only about football.
All that today on The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, right here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Stack with me, Tyler Brulé. Well, I'm joined today by Stephen Erlinger. He's the London Bureau Chief for The New York Times and was formerly Chief of the Paper's Bureau in Paris and Jerusalem. He's also reported for more than 120 countries and joined The Times all the way back in 1987. Welcome to The Stack.
Thank you.
Very good to have you here in Studio One, and just great to have someone who probably knows the meaning of bureau, probably more so than many other people today. And it's funny that before we went on air, we're just talking about the places you've been. I was looking at the masthead of one of the major German newsweeklies, one of the very respected German newsweeklies, the other day, and was just trying to do an analysis, counting the number of bureaus that they have, and I think it was not as many as they used to have, but it was maybe, I think, 9 or 10 still. But once upon a time, there were street addresses, and it was the 9th floor of a building, or it was the 13th floor. And now we just had just names and email addresses. And that made me think that probably the parent company has released real estate around the world, and these people are working remotely. So to kick off, is presence still important? Is it still important to build infrastructure around a journalist when they're in a far-flung place?
Well, I think you need some infrastructure, that's for sure. I mean, interestingly, we have more for our foreign correspondents now than for our national correspondents. Most of our national correspondents and their full staff people are working out of their homes or out of, you know, bedrooms. I mean, we tend not to have, you know, rental space. We have far fewer office manager types and researchers than we used to have. And of course, like many newspapers, we pay our interns and so on, but we do rely a lot on young, ambitious people, and probably, as journalism has always done, slightly misuse them. But we train them to.
We're not alone in that.
No, not at all. No, but I mean, we are proud in the sense that we do pay people. We don't let anyone work for nothing. But overseas, it's become interesting because it used to be, I've been in lots of bureaus where, you know, you were really a little monarch of this space, and you had staff and you had drivers and often you had translators and so on and so on. Now that's much reduced. Just to give you an idea, for London itself, which was of course like a Vatican for the New York Times, we're still incorporated in London as a separate company. But when I first came here for the Boston Globe in 1983, Johnny Apple, who was the bureau chief, but other bureau chiefs before him, had an apartment that the New York Times owned and paid for, had a driver, had a large sedan, had a staff, and had a membership at the Garrick. Now, all that's basically gone, which is fine. Most of that was completely unnecessary. Mm. But what we do have now, particularly in London, we have a great big newsroom because we've basically decided London will be the hub of what we hope will be a profitable future as more of a digital media company and less of a solely print-oriented one.
Well, that's a whole other program, which we can come back to that discussion. But presence, and whether that is marked by a driver and a sedan, and all of the other things that we know about as well. I mean, I can remember being here. I came into this town at the back end of the 80s as well, and knew many bureau chiefs, of course, who had three kids, and that came with, of course, depending on where they were from in the world, but it would come with, of course, yeah, full tuition at the American school or an international school in London, and all of this extraordinary support within the bureau. Now, that, yes, does create some sense of monarchy, but is that halo effect also important to some extent? If someone sees that you are a serious player, that you have all of these trappings, that you're from a well-oiled company. Now, everyone knows that the New York Times is that, but I'm wondering if there was a difference in status then compared to now.
I think not in journalistic terms. I mean, I still, because, you know, I'm the bureau chief and I'm a foreign staffer and I've been around the world a lot, I'm still, I think, on the tail end of the good days, in the sense that I do get, for example, a housing subsidy so I can live in central London. I have expenses. I can entertain modestly, but I can entertain.
Are we going out after we get off air?
Let's. I can travel. I don't have to check, you know, travel with anybody. I mean, you know, we go economy, which is great. It's fine. I'm not that tall or big. I have no issues with those things. I think in these days, no one really expects you to wear a tie all the time. No one really expects the New York Times bureau chief to be an ambassador necessarily. But to me, presence is partly running around, is seeing people, is traveling, is getting out of London, you know, going to the north, going to Essex, going wherever, Scotland, wherever the story is, trying to look at the country or what you're covering with a kind of sympathetic distance, even a kind of coldness. But it's important. I mean, the Times still carries weight. It matters. It matters less to some people than to others. I mean, for example, when I was here in the 80s, even as a young kid from the Boston Globe, I had interviews with Margaret Thatcher in Downing Street. And we had regular lobby briefings for the American correspondents. And when I came back, I spoke to Cameron's chief of staff, who's someone that I knew pretty well. And I mentioned this, and he, particularly this weekly lobby with Downing Street, and he looked at me and said, well, why would we do that? Right? I mean, no, they didn't care about the United States nearly as much as Thatcher did. I mean, clearly, Cameron cared about Europe and he cared about lots of things, but a much different attitude, I think, toward the press, much less willing to sit down with correspondents in an open way, much more eager to kind of control media opportunities live on television or sort of BuzzFeed-y things. So that despite pushing and despite, you know, all kinds of promises, I never did get an interview with David Cameron, which was rather surprising. He wasn't actually that interested.
I'm curious, and I'm sure there's many listeners who are still having trouble on a Saturday or a Wednesday, and are probably correcting themselves because they're still in the world of the International Herald Tribune, and they find International New York Times a mouthful. But nevertheless, International New York Times is here and hopefully here to stay on paper, at least on the weekends anyway. Tell us how it functions. You talk about the scale of the newsroom here, and many in the business know there's been a big mobilization on this side of the Atlantic and just the expansion of real estate. How do the mechanics of the paper work? Does it play out the same in Hong Kong or somewhere else in Asia? But what does the day look like in the New York Times now?
Okay. Well, we have basically a rolling editors and reporters 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So we have, you know, obviously our main newsroom is in New York. We have a big newsroom now in London, including a copy desk and editors and photo editors and graphics types. And we also have one in Hong Kong. So that kind of covers the cycle. We have to keep the 24/7 digital New York Times up to date. At the same time, we're very, very, very eager to keep the print papers alive. The International New York Times, you know, still sells 200,000 or so copies, which is not much down from what it used to be, it is important. It's important for us in Asia also. So we're thinking about how to keep it going, but to spend a little less making it. Mm. So I think in October, we're going to do another revision, which will be mostly edited now in New York and Hong Kong. We're shutting down the Paris production operation, mm-hmm. though the journalists will stay there. And it will probably have less live news because that comes digitally. It always feels late in print anyway. And we'll have, I think, a bigger variety of material available from the larger New York Times. So you'll see more op-ed pieces, including perhaps one on the front page. You'll have more culture stories, more book reviews, probably more fashion, more features, more magazine pieces, and a little less emphasis on breaking news to reduce the number of pages that have to be changed between editions. So that's, and we're kind of looking at it as a way to see how this works, because we do very much want to preserve a print version of what we produce.
Do you think that could even mean an upgrade, given what the show is called, an upgrade in paper? I'm always surprised that, you know, if we look back to the early 90s when everyone was sort of scratching their heads, we had sort of the dawn of all things digital. And in boardrooms in New York and London and Paris and Hamburg, everyone was thinking, oh, this is great future on the screen. So why don't we just cut whatever we can from the paper bill and from the photo budget, et cetera, and we'll send it all this way. And then suddenly people weren't buying magazines, because the magazines weren't what they used to be. You know, is that a danger for a newspaper as well, to say, well, let's just do it as cheap as we possibly can, when in fact you're not a tabloid in the sense on this side of the Atlantic. If I look at most of the people sitting in a lounge in Tokyo and Hong Kong who are reading the International New York Times, it looks like a pretty well-scrubbed, polished bunch, and who know the value of quality between their fingertips.
Well, we have a niche. We're an elitist paper. I mean, we're basically a paper for aspirational people, for richer people, for people interested in certain kinds of topics. And I think for people who want a kind of relatively objective American view, even of their own domestic politics. I mean, we still have great global aspirations. We spend an enormous amount of money on news gathering rather than just taking it from other people or curating it or collating it the way many websites do. And we are spending more. I mean, our theory, and I believe it's correct, which is our future remains as a subscription-driven newspaper. And we have, unlike, for example, The Guardian, I mean, we charge money to digital subscribers. We now have 1.4 million digital subscribers who are contributing, you know, obviously non-advertising revenue to the company. Now, it's not yet as much as we get from our print operations, but it's getting there, and we will cross the line pretty soon, and that's going to keep us alive. It's still, you know, touch and go, but because we have readers who are willing to pay, and it's not that much money, actually, I'm doing an ad here, and you get complete access to our archives too, it seems worth it for people. But digital advertising, as you're well aware, is a dicey operation, particularly on phones. It's much harder to do good display advertising on smartphones, and people are paying less. You know, I mean, advertisers are smart.
Well, listen, I picked up your August issue of T the other day, which is your big women's number, and I can imagine that, you know, it took me a very long time to get to the table of contents. Yeah, so hooray for your advertising team, but, you know, hooray for, of course, the board and everyone else. And you it's quite clear to anyone who's in the business and even beyond that those pages up front are probably sustaining a lot of bureaus around.
Well, this
the world.
Is right. T is very important to us. I mean, T makes money for us. I mean, sometimes we joke about whether its journalistic standards are the same as the rest. I once asked our standards editor about something, and he laughed. He said, yeah, every once in a while I have to go over there and remind them what the T stands for. But it's very important. Our cultural coverage is very important. I mean, the days when you had these huge full-page movie ads, which drove the paper, I was culture editor of the New York Times for a time, and it had a huge staff, and we turned out more pages than anybody else, and we made a lot of money on movie ads and theater ads. Now, that's still there, but it's changing. So the back of the book is really very important to the Times, as are efforts at, you know, having a better style section. And we've redone the magazine, you know, which we want to be vivid and different and to stand on its own feet. I mean, we brought in a new editor from the Texas Monthly, and I think it's working. But a lot of it is a question of who's bringing in what. I mean, I spend money. I don't make money, generally.
Yeah, well, and that's also probably always been the case with most people, fingers clattering across a keyboard. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. We are talking to Stephen Erlander. He is the London bureau chief for The New York Times. We're going away for a very short break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about a newspaper of a different kind. We'll be jumping over to Berlin. Stay with us.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Well, Germany's love affair with soccer, or as some might insist, football, is famously ferocious. But as some traditional publishers eye a digital-only future, German newspaper Bild has just launched a new print title dedicated entirely to football. Edition number one of Fußball Bild newspaper is out on German newsstands now, and its editor, Matthias Brueggemann, joins me on the line now from Berlin. Hello, Matthias.
Hello, Tyler.
Well, tell me, of course, we know that you're under the Springer umbrella. Of course, you have the backing and support of course, being under the banner of Western Europe's biggest circulating newspaper. So why the need for a further extension, Matthias?
Well, actually, it has always been our dream to produce a daily sports newspaper. You know, you have the Gazzetta in Italy, the L'Equipe in France, Us or Marca in Spain. And now we just want to fill this gap because we really believe in a product that is only about football. Our biggest love here in Germany, I think, same like in your country.
Well, it's interesting, though, because if you look at Gazzetta dello Sport, as the name implies, it started off as a title, yes, devoted to the broader world of sport, but yes, very much focused on football in general. But of course, it does extend into other areas. I'm wondering, from your point of view, why only football? Because, you know, is it because also rugby is not particularly important in the German market? Motor racing perhaps doesn't have quite the fan base. Why the singular focus?
We realize that football is really the number one sports in Germany. And I think it started with the World Cup in 2006, and it's growing and growing, and then we won the World Cup 2014, maybe you remember it. And it's still growing. The enthusiasm is so big that we decided, keep it focused. Let's say we only handle the number one sports. We forget about all the other things, which are actually not that popular right now. You know, since Michael Schumacher finished with Formula One, it's not the same anymore. And there is no big German boxing star, for example. Let me mention here Henry Maske. Everybody was watching. But really, it's all about football right now. And we think, let's name it Fußball Bild, because it's about football, so the readers really know what this new product is about.
Of course, it demands the question, in an era when football matches end late and results are, of course, very important, and even play-by-play analysis. We see so many media brands now, Matthias, of course, you know, demanding that you go to your mobile phone and, of course, follow the match, you know, if you're in a restaurant. why print paper? Because many people have just said that, yeah, in fact, sport more than anything else doesn't demand a newspaper anymore. Or is this a launch pad or a supplement to drive digital? Because, of course, we know that Dr. Dupfner, while he likes paper, I think some would argue that he likes digital even a little bit more.
You know, we really love digital here at Axel Springer and also at Bild, of course, and we are very successful with Bild.de, but still we are also very successful with our papers, especially with Bild, with a circulation at about 1.8 million every day. And I personally think that a paper, a newspaper, still has something special with the beginning and an end, with a structure which makes it very easy to understand what is important, what is less important. And the way we do Fußball Bild, you can compare it with a best-of album with some bonus tracks. You know, we take the sports coverage out of Bild and Bild.de, and then we mix some exclusive bonus tracks like columns, graphics, or historical stories out of football. And this is a completely new product, a mixture you cannot find anywhere else. And that's the reason why we say, come on, let's give paper a chance in these digital years.
Well, we like that. I can hear people cheering in the stack stands here. We think that's great. But I think there's probably a lot of publishers who might be listening to this interview, Matthias, who are also wondering, when you talk about carving something out of the main paper, that means only you're pulling only the football out, but some sport remains. Those few sports that Germans want to read about, or would you say, if you're not familiar with the paper, that day in and day out, Bild Zeitung is mostly focusing on football?
Well, Bild Zeitung is focusing on football, but it's not football only. Bild Zeitung has every day between 3 or 4 pages of sports, and always one page is about Formula One, boxing, ski jumping, you name it. And this should also be a difference between Fußball Bild and Bild Zeitung. So you still know when you want to know about all the highlights happening in sports on 3 or 4 pages, you better buy Bild. But if you're one of these football nerds and you love this sport so much and you want to know about all the clubs, not only the club in the town you're living in and the international clubs, then you better buy Fußball Bild.
Perfect pitch there. Matthias Brueggemann, editor of Fußball Bild, also deputy editor at Bild Zeitung in Berlin. Very, very good to talk to you. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. You're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé, also Stephen Erlinger is here at the bureau chief for The New York Times. We were talking before we dashed off to Berlin for a brief moment there about the metabolism, how the newsroom operation works across, you know, New York to Hong Kong, passing back to London. I just want to go back to bureaus for a moment. And at the start of the show, you were saying the national bureaus are now mostly people working independently. Of course, they're staff members, but they're working from home. But, you know, I can think back to when I came to this city. Bureaus were important for also cutting your teeth as a young journalist, finding your way in the front door, and whether it was making coffee or photocopies, whatever you had to do, that's how you did it. You know, it's great that that has a role sort of elsewhere around the world. But I'm wondering, you know, how does the New York Times, is there a house view when you look at the future of journalists and not people in the business of storytelling, that dreadful word, but people who want to be editors? Is it to bring them into New York? You're going to cut your teeth on the floor there if you're, doesn't matter whether you're from Indiana or Wisconsin. I'm just wondering, what does that sort of uptake of young talent look like today?
Well, it's very interesting because there are a lot of people who, despite the dire economic forecasts everyone has about newspapers, desperately want to come work for us and to be journalists. And, you know, we're very lucky because we get to pick very good people and train them, you know. I mean, I'm very proud of some of the people I've hired as interns and then have brought on and who've either gotten staff jobs with us or elsewhere. I mean, this is something I care about. It's something people help me do, and I feel it a great obligation. But for editors, it's kind of a different route. I mean, The Times is a very heavily edited newspaper. And again, we tend not to take people in their first jobs as editors. We tend to hire people who've already had some experience. And in New York, we tend to put them through quite a difficult copy editing test and so on. Now, this is for copy editors, and then, but when we used to have kind of very much desk bound editors. There was an editor who really did for the foreign desk. I remember her name was Jeannie Pinder. She had a tremendous expertise on the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. She spoke fluent Russian. She had, you know, she was the style guide of how we transliterated Russian. She was quite fearsome. Now, those sorts of people, we can't really afford that in the same way. There's still people with expertise, but we have a kind of on a national foreign copy desk is pretty much put together. We still have story editors on the foreign desk who do have regional expertise. And we have more, you know, continuous news editors who also do some writing. I mean, it is something that is very much in play. But in general, editors tend to first come either from another professional organization or come through the New York training ground. But we're always looking for good copy editors because, you know, we still, to some degree, are the hours are not great. And those people tend to graduate then up to become story editors who are dealing more directly with the first drafts of stories before they then go to the copy desk.
Stephen Erlinger of the New York Times, very good to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Today's show is produced by Ben Ryland and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our editor today, Cassie Galpin. If you have any comments or queries, then do drop us a note to info@monocle.com. Remember, we're back at the same time next Saturday. And of course, you can always listen again at monocle.com or via your favorite podcast platform. This has been The Stack. I'm Tyler Brulé. Have a good weekend. Goodbye.